seed catalogs are arriving, and some of us are already dreaming of spring. And some of us are thinking about what we're going to do differently this year in the garden. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's the first Horticulture Day of 2013. Horticulturist Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension is here, along with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. We are going to make some resolutions for our gardens and in support of insect life today. And we want to know, what are your resolutions? What new things are you hoping to try in your garden this year? Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's the first Horticulture Day of 2013. And although your garden is sleeping under a blanket of white right now, it's time to start dreaming of spring. Today, we're going to make some New Year's resolutions for our gardens and also in support of insect life. And with me now, horticulturist Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension. Hello, Richard. We'll get to you in a second. In Ames? We're having a small technical problem. All right. As soon as we get that fixed, I'll talk to Richard and Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist. And we want to hear from you today as well. We want to hear about your resolutions for your garden. And also tell us what you're hoping to try that's new this year. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We already have a resolution on our Facebook page as well. This is from Constance, and she says, I'll plant more gold nugget sweet potatoes from Seed Savers Exchange. They are the best. Also hope to get at some overdue splitting of old perennials and to share and put in new places. So please share your resolutions with us today. And good morning, Richard Giron.
Good morning.
So nice to hear you. Happy New
Year. I was here. But...
I know you were. And Donald Lewis, hello.
Hello, Charity. I'm here too.
That's wonderful. We're all here now. And let's start with some resolutions. I have the same one every year, and someday I'm totally going to follow through on keeping up with the weeds in my garden. That's a pretty basic one. But Richard, do you have a resolution to kick us off?
To plant a tree this spring. And not to plant a common tree, like a maple or an oak or a linden, but something different. Maybe a Kentucky coffee tree.
Oh, what's a Kentucky coffee tree like?
Well, it's actually a legume, and it has these big pods, so make sure you choose a male cultivar. But it's actually, I believe, native to much of Eastern North America, and it has these big compound leaves. But you rarely see it in the landscape. But you want to make sure you choose a male tree that doesn't have the pods.
Okay. And part of this resolution is to work on creating a little more variety in
right.
the landscape in Iowa.
Because when you go to the nursery, they typically have row of autumn blaze maple, which is a nice tree, but you don't have to plant an autumn blaze maple. So it could be like a Kentucky coffee tree, it could be a tulip tree, it could be a sweet gum. There are so many good trees that we can plant that we rarely see in the landscape.
And, of course, when we're thinking about this, we're also thinking about the emerald ash borer ever
Correct.
Making its way closer and the fact that something could happen to all those autumn blaze maples someday as well.
It could. And you could also plant maybe a Dutch elm disease-resistant American elm. Because we have those varieties now, things like Jefferson, Princeton, so we can actually see more American elms in the future.
All right. Donald, do you have a first resolution for us?
Oh, I think the one that connects most to my personal life and my professional life is that my resolution is to eat more insect-pollinated foods in the coming year. And, of course, that means more fruits and vegetables. On the national average right now, about one out of every three bites that we eat comes from a food source that was pollinated by an insect. Doesn't have to be honeybees. And, of course, the problems that honeybees have had recently sort of emphasizes the ecological service of pollination that we get from lots of insects and other animals. There are other bees that are native bees or wild bees that are not honeybees that are responsible for pollinating things like our squash and our pumpkins and our melons. And recognizing the importance of those insects is one of the things that I've been talking about as I go around the state. And carrying that home and then eating more of those insect-pollinated foods is what I resolve to do.
All right. And to also think about the fact that they're insect-pollinated foods is probably part of this resolution as well.
Well, it certainly does. And if you start down this line with someplace like the Natural Resource Conservation Service, pollinator habitat improvement, or for more the local gardeners, you can contact the Xerces Society. That's X-E-R-C-E-S. Xerces started out as a butterfly advocacy group, and they have morphed into pollinator advocacy as well. That one of the things we do to encourage these native pollinators, to encourage the ecological service that is provided by all of these native pollinators, is to make sure we plant things they need. And so we diversify our landscapes as much as we can. We leave weeds and we have flowers blooming throughout the year, and not just in your flower bed, but we should be trying more for native ecosystems in our roadsides, like we already have with the DOT programs, and other areas where we can encourage biodiversity to help the pollinators survive and thrive.
And I think a lot of us have read a lot about the problems with honeybees, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of us have become honeybee supporters in our hearts. But do you think that the native pollinators don't get as much credit, that we still think, oh, that might sting us?
Certainly. As you look out, in the native pollinators people are most likely to see are the bumblebees and the sweat bees. And those have always been here. What we call the honeybee, the European honeybee, was brought from Europe by the first American European settlers. And it became an invasive species and moved across the continent ahead of the European settlers and displaced some of these native pollinators. And it became so easy to manage and easy to manage in large numbers that it became essential to many of our food supplies. And the problems that we now face with honeybees do bring us back to, well, wait a minute, what was already here that we probably should be paying more attention to? But when you get right down to it, if you must have pollination service and you must have a lot of it right now, there is nothing better suited than the honeybee that we can load on trucks, drive 2,000 miles across the country so that those almond orchards in California are pollinated in the week when they need that pollination.
But we also need to think about just being more tolerant of everything that flies and maybe even stings.
Yes, and that's my other New Year's resolution, is to plant more butterfly pollinator-friendly plants. Now, the other way I can justify that is a pollinator-friendly habitat, a butterfly-friendly habitat, is going to be untidy by many people's definitions. So I can be a lazy gardener. I can let those weeds grow. My monarch butterflies need the milkweeds. Some of my other caterpillars need that occasional thistle. If we could leave those kinds of habitats in fence rows and along roadsides and in grass waterways, if we could establish more prairies, we would be helping those as well. So I resolve to be an untidy gardener this coming year.
Is that going to be easy or hard?
Well, you would think it would be easy because you just let grow whatever is there. You try to establish more native plants. But when you talk about establishing native plants, some of them are a little harder to find. We know they're going to work better if I plant them in clumps rather than in scattered individuals. And I think some of these plants are fairly finicky and not terribly easy to establish. So it may take a little work to be untidy, but I'm going to give it a try.
Well, and there are a lot of plants already in the environment that are growing really well and are very strong. So they can crowd out new native plants as well.
Right. And we do plant some invasive things. I've made some mistakes over the years, and I have areas of ground cover that are now 100% ground cover, and I wish there were a little more diversity in those areas. But getting back to what was here first, establishing those native areas would be good for the ecosystems.
All right. Richard, do you have another one?
To visit a public garden this spring or summer. That could be in Iowa, like Ryman Gardens in Ames, or the Des Moines Botanic Center in Des Moines, or the Dubuque Arboretum. But to take the time to maybe take a few minutes from your busy schedule and visit a garden.
You know, I think that's something that a lot of us think about doing with kids. You know, when we have kids, we start thinking, oh, we need to educate them and take them to special places and stuff like that. But that's something we should be doing no matter what, right?
Right. And we actually, in this region of the country, the Midwest, we have some of the best gardens in the world. We have the Chicago Botanic Garden, the Missouri Botanic Garden, Morton Arboretum. The Morton Arboretum has a wonderful children's garden. So we have some of the best gardens here in the Midwest.
Where is Morton Arboretum?
Lisle, Illinois, a suburban Chicago community.
And Richard, as a professional gardener, when you go to one of these gardens, what are you looking at?
Just looking at some of the old specimens that they might have. They typically have collections of maybe certain plants that you don't see here in the Midwest too much in Iowa. So they may have some very old, unusual trees or shrubs. Many of these places also have demonstration gardens. So you can see what you could actually might do in your own landscape when you look at something, see how it performs, and then take that idea and maybe alter it a little bit and try it in your landscape.
All right. That goes beyond my, wow, that's really pretty experience.
Well, that too. That too.
That too. And oftentimes, if you are establishing your landscape, if you bought a new property and you are thinking of changing things, we have a lot of local options from the Iowa Arboretum over by Madrid to the Cedar Valley Arboretum at Waterloo. There's an arboretum over by Newton and the Beckelhaupt Arboretum in Clinton. None of us are very far from one of these public display gardens that features woody plants. And I think getting those established early and getting those ideas, seeing what it's going to look like, and of course what that helps you do is, my gosh, those are big plants. And when you bring the little one home from the garden center, you recognize that I have to give this thing space to grow.
Well, and also we should mention that since we've been talking about native plants too, that there are a number of really beautiful prairies that can be visited.
Correct.
In Iowa and
right.
surrounding states as well, if you're
right.
interested in seeing what our original landscape looked like.
And seeing if it would fit for you to establish a meadow in your property as opposed to mowing so much Kentucky bluegrass.
Like 2 acres of, you know, Kentucky right. bluegrass.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break. When we get back, we want to hear your resolutions, and we want to hear about the new things you want to try in your garden this year or in your yard. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Richard Geron and Donald Lewis of Iowa State University Extension. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's the first Horticulture Day of 2013, and with me, horticulturist Richard Geron of Iowa State University Extension and entomologist Donald Lewis of Iowa State University Extension. They're here today to answer your questions, and we're also talking about New Year's resolutions for your garden. What do you hope to try this year that you've never done before? Do you need a little advice about it? And, of course, if you have any questions about the plants, the trees in your landscape, insects, or your houseplants, give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we've got Terry on the line from Dubuque. Hi, Terry.
Hey, good morning. Thank you.
Hi, what's your resolution?
Well, I have two, actually. First, I want to, this year, plant the Three Sisters. Mm-hmm. The corn and the beans and the pumpkins and or squash mm-hmm. combination, I think that would be a great learning experience, not only for me, but also for my young son. And also, I'm going to get my melons to actually grow this year because my young son just loves cantaloupe, and I would love to have that, be able to grow some this year and have him enjoy cantaloupe right out of the garden.
And what have the problems been with your melons in the past?
Well, this year, for whatever, part of it was, I think the drought really affected their pollination. But I think this, I have some sort of critter, for lack of a better term, that comes in and eats my melon plants off right to the ground. And I've planted watermelons 4 or 5 times this spring, and I planted cantaloupe a couple of times, and I just had no luck. And when I finally did get cantaloupes, then they would actually just chew holes right through the melons themselves and eat them from the inside out. So I have no idea how to counter that. But
I think we need to know what it is, and part of the son's learning experience will be to spend a night in the garden watching to see which critter it is coming out to eat. Large holes, eating into melons, chewing off seedlings, does sound a little more like rodents or rabbits than it sounds like insects. Cutworms early in the season could do it, but we don't have very many cutworms in tilled soil areas, and we have very few cutworms in the garden. The bigger problems with melons are frequently a little later in the season when you get bacterial wilt and so forth. Mm-hmm. We also need to be looking at cucumber beetles. But what did you think the problem was, Richard?
Well, I wasn't sure, but to plant those in Dubuque around probably May 10th, May 15th, plant them in hills, typically 4 to 5 seeds in a hill, and then thin those down to 2 or 3. Make sure there's plenty of space between the hills, and just give them plenty of space. They need a well-drained soil. They don't like wet, poorly drained sites. And beyond that, just keep the weeds down.
So. And I've done that, and I have good luck with the seedlings actually growing from seeds. They come up real nicely. I thin them out, and then something comes through and just eats them right off to the ground. And I did the same thing with my I planted sunflowers this year. Something came through and ate those down to the ground. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea. Yeah, maybe it's just me standing out there
now,
for 2 days with a pitchfork and shooing them all away. I don't know what I need to do.
When you say they ate them back to the ground, did they just cut them off, or did they actually eat the vine right back to the ground?
No, everything's gone.
Everything's gone.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, we could try rabbit fencing, ground squirrel fencing here.
I was going to say, can you plant them in a cage?
I can do all that, sure. Yeah.
The cucumber beetles, the striped cucumber beetle especially, will chew off the muskmelon and the cucumber seedlings. They would not have attacked the sunflowers. And when they chew them off, Richard was going to the same direction I was, that they just take some bites and the thing sort of flops over and there's your dead wilted plant on the ground, almost severed off completely. But to have completely disappeared sounds like a bigger mammal kind of a pest.
Normally rabbits don't bother them because they're kind of spiny or prickly, the leaves are. And so they tend not to really bother them much. But if you want to make sure, just put a chicken wire fence around the plants or the garden area. That should keep them out. I don't think deer would find them very attractive either. So I'm not sure exactly what could be eating those.
And the interesting thing was I planted cantaloupe very not far from watermelon. And the cantaloupe was never touched until I actually had cantaloupes. And then they would eat the cantaloupes. But the watermelons is what kept eating off down to the ground. And then when I did put chicken wire around them, it still happened. So something, is it a mouse or is it a ground squirrel? We've got tons of ground squirrels in the neighborhood. So I don't know if it's them that are coming and they're eating them. I don't think it's raccoons. There's a lot of raccoons, too.
Plant many hills so that they all will not be affected. Logic would say they wouldn't be.
Yeah, let's see how logical the animals are next year.
Right. Oh,
well,
good luck, Terry.
Thank you very much. And I thought maybe it's just the drought this year for whatever, and they're hungry and they're eating whatever they can find. So
that's a possibility, but stake the kid into the garden and let us know what he finds.
I will do. Thank you very much.
Well, and Richard, Terry mentioned planting Three Sisters, which is a companion planting method. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works?
Basically, you plant corn, you plant something like a pumpkin, and the third one is?
Beans.
Right. And basically, the squash can actually kind of, or the pumpkin, can actually grow up the corn. as a support, and they all kind of benefit each other, and you end up with a nice crop.
All right, and the beans climb the corn as well, so you don't need to stake the beans.
Right, if you have like a pole bean.
And the beans fix nitrogen, which the other plants can eat, and you end up with kind of a nice succotash or stew kind of a meal with your squash, your beans, and your corn all together.
That sounds like a lot of fun to do. I've often thought that that would be good. We live right next to a cornfield often, so I rarely plant corn because of the cross-pollination problems. But let's go back to the phones at 866-780-9100. Diane is on the line from Vinton. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
First of all, has that guy considered he might have woodchucks?
Oh, groundhogs, yeah.
That, but anyway, my resolution is to plant more prairie plants as specimen plants. You talk about prairie, you know, needing a lot of space. Actually, prairie plants, if you plant them individually, can make a fantastic border of lots of textures and shapes and colors. And I don't think people consider that enough. Plus, I have friends, people come out to learn the different grasses and stuff by looking at the individual specimens. That's kind of fun.
Right. Purple cone, flower, butterfly weed, absolutely.
Oh, and all the grasses.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Prairie drop seed and Cydotes grama and a lot of that. And it's easy to manage to, you know, you just treat them like a plant, weed around them, and you just get an incredible mix. And even, you know, as in you go into the fall, there's all these different colors. Mm-hmm. And even now, there's colors and textures that that you look at that you don't maybe see if you look at the whole prairie just in one mass.
Yeah, I've never thought about it that way, Diane, to break
beautiful.
It down a little bit. That's neat.
It's beautiful. Plus, you know they're going to grow because they're a native plant.
Right. They're low maintenance, typically for the most part, pest-free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very good attributes.
The only thing, it's kind of a challenge maybe to find the plants. You might have to order them.
Exactly, or work with friends. The one downside is you may be able to do this meadow prairie establishment, but I can't because I don't have enough sunshine.
Mm. Yeah, see, I have.
But then you can use.
This is done in total. Although I am, I had quite a bit of timber destroyed in that big storm that came through Vin, and I'm looking to find out what kind of plants I can grow that would be more like oak savanna around the edges of that.
You probably have a lot more sunshine than you used to have.
Sure do.
Oh. I'm sorry, but it's nice only, to make the best of it.
My only management problem I haven't figured out yet is how I'm going to burn off these big clumps of grass that are 5 feet from my deck.
Probably not a good thing to burn them.
And maybe mowing there is a good idea.
Cut them off. Yes, cut them off.
Yeah, probably will. So.
All right, be careful, Diane. Thanks a lot for your call.
Happy New Year to you all.
Yes.
I really appreciate your program.
Happy New Year. And you can join us with your questions or your resolutions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. Mara had a very similar resolution. She says she's planning to plant more native flowers and grasses. They attract so many beautiful butterflies and birds and bees. And we'd love to hear from you as well. Let's go back to the phone. Sue is on the line from Pleasant Hill. Hi, Sue.
Hi. It was interesting to hear the discussion from the gentleman about the melons and something eating his things off. Mm-hmm. But we'd like to try this year. My grandchildren are very successful with their garden. They have great help from their parents since they're like 4 to 12. But last year, my girlfriend and I were out, and she said, do I remember correctly that we used to have great big watermelons? And I said, yes. And I did find a source for black diamond seeds, and I can buy as few as a dozen. And for me, I would have to grow them in a very large container, and I wanted to divide the seeds, you know, one hill. Would something like that work? To try to grow a black diamond, or do I need to purchase more seeds? Can I put 4 seeds in a large pot of loamy soil and expect a crop, or any suggestions?
Well, you could just have one hill of watermelons. That's perfectly fine.
Okay.
But if it's a container, it's going to have to be like a whiskey barrel, I think, something huge.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to have space for the vines to grow out onto. Okay.
I have that.
Okay.
I have that.
So to spill over, you mean?
Right, to spill over onto that surface. Mm-hmm. It could be a patio or some other surface or whatever.
You mentioned a whiskey barrel. Doesn't that seem like the vines would have to go a long way down? Would there be a breaking issue if there wasn't something supportive higher?
I don't think it would. They're pretty limber, and so they would just kind of spill down the sides and then run out onto the surface. It could be a gravel driveway or whatever. And they would be able to get their sun, and so they would be able to flower and then produce the fruit, so long as they have space once they do start to vine out.
Right. And that was, I didn't know. The seeds were relatively expensive. My girlfriend does have, they have a very small garden, and her husband's quite a do-it-herselfer, or himselfer, so they have a great deer fence around their garden. I live in town, so I only have the occasional deer to come to munch, but I wasn't certain about the pot concept. And my daughter, they're out in the country between Marion and Cedar Rapids, and she's very good to spray deer repellent on some of her plants in the garden. And she knows which ones to spray that on and which ones not to spray that on. And that seems to help with some of the critters. How late or what's the time of year to plant watermelon as far north as Cedar Rapids?
I would plant those sometime around May 10th. And as far as the container, make sure it has drainage holes in the bottom so it can drain.
Yeah.
And I would use a commercial potting mix in the actual container. Don't use garden soil, but actually use a commercial potting mix.
Mm-hmm.
And a single plant can produce fruit. You have separate male and female flowers on the same plant. They're pollinated by bees and other pollinators. So you could actually have a single watermelon plant, and it can produce fruit.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. Because it's been fun. My daughter, gardening was not her thing when she was growing up, and her father and I did it. And so it's been fun to watch her take all those books home and learn about container gardening and square foot gardening, which they put in a lovely bed and have just had wonderful luck with it. In a very small space. So I just really always enjoy your shows, and I'm always glad when you come back on every Friday during the growing season instead of...
Well, it's only 2 months away, Sue.
I know. But thanks. So, yeah, the seeds were kind of pricey, and I appreciate your help, and I didn't realize that a single plant would produce both male and female blossoms.
Right. And so,
is that true for squash and pumpkin as well?
It's true for them, too. So let's say you plant 5 seeds in that pot or whatever. Take the other 5 seeds, leave them in the envelope, keep them in a cool, dry place, and you can use those next spring.
All right, Sue. Thank you so much for your call. And let's get to our next caller, Brandon, on the line from Webster. Hi, Brandon.
Hello.
Hi. What's your resolution for this year?
Well, my resolution is I'm going to practice this new concept I heard about called hugel culture.
And what is that?
It's basically you bury some like downed logs, like some tree trunks, you make a pyramid shape, and then you bury them. And the word is you only have to irrigate it once, one initial irrigation at the beginning of the season, and the downed logs held moisture, and it's supposed to be really good for drought. And I was just wondering if the specialists there know anything about that, can give me any special tips about it.
I'm not familiar with that concept, and I guess my initial reaction is I'm not sure it's going to work that well. I do agree on certain aspects of it, that adding organic matter to the soil, things like compost, barnyard manure, is a good thing in that it holds the moisture. So that is definitely a good thing, and any gardener can do that. The other thing I would also add is that once you have the things planted, if you use a mulch, like grass clippings or straw or something of that nature, that can also be very, very beneficial and reduce water evaporation. So there are some very good procedures that you can do, but I'm not sure those logs buried in the ground are going to be that helpful.
Well, and Brandon, I'm looking at information about this online. This looks like it could be quite the undertaking. How big a space are you planning to try this in?
Well, I'm initially just going to try one basic little hill first just to see how it works.
Well, but, why don't you try it and you let us know how it works, okay?
Let us know. We'll come see your pyramid of buried logs. Yeah.
Well, I'm certainly going to give it a try. I mean, with the drought really giving farmers a lot of guff, but, you know, it's worth a try to really try anything new.
Sure. All right, Brandon. But, thanks a lot for your call and good luck.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Did he say Hugel culture?
It's a, I wasn't sure.
I looked it up. It's Hugelkultur. So I believe it originated in Germany.
Okay.
So sounds like
something new to learn about this year for all of us. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to take more of your questions and listen to more of your resolutions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture, and entomologist Donald Lewis, also from ISU Extension. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we're talking about some of the resolutions we're making for our gardens this spring and in support of insect life in Iowa. With me, entomologist Donald Lewis from Iowa State University Extension and also Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And James is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, James.
Good morning. I was dilatory in getting the snow off of one of my pine trees, and I have a couple of major branches that have broken near the bottom third.
Okay.
So what's my best bet to try to save the tree?
Well, it's not going to kill the tree per se, but I'd probably go out maybe this weekend if it gets warm enough to melt the snow off the branches and prune off those broken branches.
How far back?
Well, if, for example, there's nothing green beyond the inside the break, then the entire branch has to come off.
Clear back to the trunk.
Clear back to the trunk.
But they have to be broken in order to be that drastic. What if they're just bent down?
No, I'm looking out and I can see the core bark. Not bark, the core wood.
Right. So if they're partially broke, they're not going to heal. It's always going to be a weak point, and at some point it's going to break off completely, so you want to go out and prune those off. And if you have to, then you have to prune it back to the branch, to the actual trunk. There's no need to treat the pruning cut. You can do that any time in the next few weeks, no problem there.
All right. Thank you. Enjoy the show. Always have a question for you.
All right, James. Thanks a lot for your call. And we have an email on the pretty much the same subject. Skip says, I had several branches break off of a pine tree due to the heavy snow in December. Mm-hmm. I'd like to trim those back to the trunk. When is the best time to do that? Now, we just found out where to trim them to, but is there a time that's better?
I would do it as soon as you can, as soon as convenient. The concern is that we could have a future storm. Let's say next week we could have an ice storm. You have additional weight. It might break off. And as that branch breaks off, it could actually damage other branches. So I would do it as soon as you can at your convenience.
Okay. Let's do another question from email. This is Ryan from Reasoner. He says, I have a cyclamen with a persistent scales infestation. I've been washing the leaves and removing the scales. Do you have a product that you'd recommend to help me out?
I think I would use the waste basket for this one.
How about compost pile?
Or compost. There you go, Richard. I would use the compost pile. When houseplants are infested, it's just you're always pushing this rock uphill. Having said that the easy out would be to discard it. Of course, the challenge is, can I really beat this? And soap, insecticidal soaps that are sprayed onto the plant foliage on a regular basis, and I mean weekly, will help get ahead of it, as well as the cleaning, the mechanical control that's already being done. So insecticidal soap would be one opportunity or possibility where you actually make a mess by spraying the plant with soap and then rinsing it off, and that's probably best done in the shower so you aren't getting the soaps all over everywhere. There are insecticides that can be added to potting soil or to potted plants that are systemic that come up through the plant. You have to think long and hard. Is this what you want to do? Some of these are fairly persistent. They're going to be there for a while. They're certainly in the traditional insecticide group. There's nothing organic about them. But Dicistan is still available in granules or little sticks that you put down into potting soil. Some formulations of imidacloprid, an insecticide that we use for treating roses and shrubs and trees outdoors, is labeled for potting soil or for potted plants. So there are those two insecticides that can be used as systemics in the soil. I'm not a strong proponent of those. I think there's more questions than answers at the moment about using those indoors, but that would be sort of the final assault against scales and mealybugs and aphids, would be to use a systemic insecticide from the garden center.
All right, and Ryan has another question too. He says, I have a dwarf Meyer lemon with a leaf problem. The mature leaves get a mottled appearance with a bit of dewy residue on the back. What's causing that, and how would you treat it?
On the back?
Mm-hmm.
On the underside.
What kind of dwarf lemon?
Meyer. Dwarf Meyer lemon.
Well, this is one where maybe a photo sent to either Richard or the Plant Disease Clinic, or sent to any of us, we'll share it around when we're stumped. But a good digital photo of what's going on sent to sickplant@iastate.edu would be a good way to start. Gooey residue, some plants just do that.
Right. At a certain point at the base of the leaf, they sometimes do that. If it were on the above surface, I would think insects.
Yes, and gooey is usually these leaf exudates. They surprise us all the time on our grapevines, on our fig leaves, in the figs that we grow inside as houseplants. That might not be the problem, but modeling sort of suggests maybe a virus or any of the other common problems: too cold, too hot, too wet, too dry.
Poor growing conditions.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, let's go to Sarah on the line in Marshalltown. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. I oversee the prairie at the library in Marshalltown, and I'm a prairie newbie. I'm getting lots of good advice. But burning the prairie, how important is that? And then also the best educational resources to educate the community about why the prairie is important.
Well, you do have the Iowa Prairie Network. That would be one place you could go. When was the actual area seeded?
You know, the library opened in 2008, and I've only been on board for the last year, so I don't know all the history, but I know the drought hurt us last year, and I think there was some neglect with the retirement of the old director, who was a great prairie proponent, and then my coming on board. So I think we're behind where we are. I think they were saying that 2013 should have been the real first year that we would see the prairie, but I think we're behind the time.
Right. It usually takes 2 or 3 years to establish a prairie area, oftentimes. The first year, you don't see much. You see a lot more weeds and actual prairie plants. They're there, but you just don't see them very much. It is a good idea, if you can, to burn a prairie periodically. It doesn't have to be done every year, but typically it is helpful if you can do it. It's typically done in the spring. Every 3 or 4 years typically should be okay if you can do it. You'd have to get permission from your county or your city to do it. But burning it would tend to eliminate maybe some of the weedy type species that might be coming in, like little trees and things like that. And it also provides nutrients for the prairie plants. So it's nice if you can do it. It's not imperative that you have to do it, but it's nice if you can do it periodically.
Well, and Sarah, Richard mentioned the Iowa Prairie Network, which is a great resource. There's also the Tallgrass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa, which is another great resource. And there are so many people who want to help you with prairies. I think if you reach out, you will get the help you need.
Including our Iowa Department of Natural Resources.
Right.
They have a prairie center and are involved with establishment and maintenance of prairies as well.
And your county conservation board possibly too.
All right, Sarah, good luck. And let's go back to the email questions. We have a number of email questions to get through today. And this one is from Marty in Lake Mills. I have several mature endless summer hydrangeas. They're 5 to 6 years old and are located on the south side of my home. They're supposed to bloom on old and new wood. I only prune out dead growth. The last 2 years, I have plenty of foliage, but no blooms. Any suggestions?
Well, apparently, they're dying back over winter, and so you're not getting the bloom on the old wood. As far as why they're not blooming on the new wood, I'm not sure on that. Make sure they get plenty of sunlight. I would say at least, 4, 5, 6 hours of sun. Preferably morning sun, afternoon shade. Make sure they have plenty of water during the growing season so they can grow. You can give them a little bit of fertilizer in the spring as they just begin to leaf out. But they should bloom on their new growth, hopefully, in late summer, no matter what happens in the wintertime.
All right, and here's another email from Dong Wang, who asks, I wonder if jujube trees, and I don't know if I said that correctly, but if a jujube tree can bear fruit in Iowa Zone 5.
I do not know.
All right.
We puzzled on that one. We stared off into space a long time
well,
before.
Well, and they're native to Madagascar, which seems like a very tropical climate.
I guess my first question is, can they live in Iowa? And then the second question is, will it produce? And
there's another one. You let us know
what
you find out.
Thank you for doing the experiment for us.
Right. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Phil is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Phil.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Hold on a second. Let me take you off speaker.
Okay.
Terribly sorry about that.
What would you like to talk about, Phil?
I am setting up a rainwater collection system off of my barn roof.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking for something. Last year I had a problem with algae in the storage tank. And I'm looking for something that I can use as an algaecide that will not only be not harmful to my garden, but also not harmful to people, because we would like to use it as a emergency source of drinking water.
Well, better shading comes to mind, that if you could keep the water in the dark, you would have less algae. What else you got, Richard?
Boy, do we have a water quality specialist on that? That'd be the place where I would go.
We've got an aquaculture specialist who tells you how to keep the algae out of your farm pond.
But that wouldn't be suitable as far as drinking it. To me, that's the biggest concern, the safety of drinking it. So to me, that would be the biggest problem, being able to drink it.
If keeping it in the dark is the simplest thing, that can be kept in the barn. That's not a huge issue. But I'm looking at 1,000 to 1,200 gallons capacity.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, what could be on the barn? You could have a bird roost on the barn.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have droppings. The droppings are there. The water goes across that. And so you have all these things in the water, which really wouldn't make it suitable for drinking.
So potentially, I think I'd probably be best off then with a post-storage treatment.
Yes.
I think you would have to have some type of treatment, yes.
Okay. And thank you very much. I do have two resolutions. One is to be a less messy gardener. I have way too many weeds.
And I'm right there with you, Phil.
And the other is to add more beehives. I've been keeping bees for about 8 years now, and the best hobby in the world.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of heavy lifting, but boy, when they perform and do well for you, it's terribly satisfying, isn't it?
All right, Phil, thank you so much for your call. We've got another resolution. This one is from Kathy. She says, I always resolve to plant something new every year. This time it will be artichokes. Any advice?
They can be a challenge. You can grow them, but oftentimes they don't form a head very well in Iowa. But they are interesting, and I would give it a shot. And don't be disappointed if they don't form a nice head.
All right. And next, we'll go back to the phones. Rosemary's on the line in Springville. Hi, Rosemary.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, last year we had a huge infestation of Japanese beetles. We live next to a bean field, and they ate everything. They ate our purple plum tree, our Boston ivy, our Chinese elm, our Virginia creeper, marigolds, irises.
Not picky, are they?
How picky are they?
No, they are. Picky. They are not picky.
Then I found out that they would like eat the beetles. The little worm things would eat the lawn.
Possibly.
So we put Milky Spore down last fall. But now, is there anything else that we can do? I mean, we can't keep them out of that bean field.
Yeah. Well, let's let the bean field go, and it's not part of the equation at all. All of us have Japanese beetles, and many of us are tens of miles from the nearest bean field. So the bean field is not a source of the Japanese beetle that eats the plants. Now, part of the confusion here is there's another insect called the multicolored Asian lady beetle that can be associated with bean fields when bean fields are infested with aphids. So we've got two words that sound kind of alike, Japanese and Asian, and they kind of get stirred together. But for the Japanese beetle, it is a white grub that lives in sod, in turf grass, and in grassy areas. So the Japanese beetle is not coming from the bean field. It's coming from fence rows and your lawns. Japanese beetle feeds on the foliage, flowers, and fruits of over 350 different plants in the middle of the summer, late June to mid-August. And when they are new to you, you have an explosion and they defoliate everything. In years, that will moderate and you will have fewer of them even if you did nothing. So this is the trend for everybody across the 59 counties in Iowa where the Japanese beetle has been reported. Yes, the populations explode and it's terrible, but it won't always be this bad. The good news is your plants aren't killed by this, but they do look terrible, and production of fruit crops like cherries and apples may be diminished. So if we're going to protect the foliage, we have to protect the foliage from the feeding damage. Killing grubs in the lawn with any insecticide does not protect your plants, the trees and shrubs and flowers, the following year, because the Japanese beetles are so highly mobile. It doesn't matter if you killed all the grubs on the property you own, you would still have defoliating beetles next summer. So having said that, we have to deal with the beetles on the plants where we need to keep the foliage on, and we can do that with either sprays or systemics. One final comment, I hope Milky Spore disease works for you. It has not been working for other people for about the last 25 to 50 years. The results are just so erratic. Sometimes it works in some places for a little while. More often, it has not been working, especially in the northern parts of the country.
All right. Well, we are out of time. I'm sure we will talk a lot more about Japanese beetles in the coming months, Donald.
Again, we'll be back.
Right. Donald Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity. Always a pleasure to be here.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist. And Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. They'll be back with Horticulture Day in 2 weeks here on Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. This is Talk of Iowa.